So my main motivation in asking to give this talk was the first law of computational physics is no matter how long you work on a code or how hard you work, it will always start working the night before your talk. So by scheduling a talk, you're forcing your code to work. And that's exactly what happened yesterday. My code actually started working. The corollary to this rule is that you don't have as many results as you want. But I still have some.
So what I'm going to be discussing is physics of magnetized rotators. And in particular, I'll be talking about pulsars. But as I'll show, the physics of pulsars is actually a prototype for many other astrophysical systems. So first, I'll do a bit of observational motivation for why strong magnetic fields are interesting, and why rotating magnetic fields are even more interesting. And then I'll review some fundamentals of pulsar electrodynamics, in particular addressing what questions we don't really understand about pulsars. And then I'll describe this new framework which several people in the world have been developing, and it seems to be quite a nice framework for studying physics of magnetized rotators. So it's force-free electrodynamics, and I'll describe the foundations of it and numerical methods that we use, and then I'll try to apply it to all sorts of rotating systems like pulsars, magnetars, and accretion disks. And then I'll summarize the current problems that we have in this business, which are current sheets. This theme has been popping up in our discussions every morning. And finally, I'll have a quiz. So take notes. Okay, so relativistic outflows, that's part of the focus of this program. And you know, some of the simple examples are thrown up here. You know, you have extragalactic jets, you have superluminal expansion, you have gamma ray bursts with enormous gamma factors outflows. And most of these, to some degree, are related to a magnetized rotating object. Some of them are more questionable than in others, but in most cases, there is some sort of an engine that's underlying the energetics of the outflow. And that engine is probably heavily magnetized and fast rotators. So in particular, pulsars are the prototype for all of these, or for most of these systems. It turns out that pulsars have their peculiarities, like the source of plasma is not as readily available as in other systems. But to zeroth order, pulsars and pulsar winds are probably a good good prototype for studying these other astrophysical outflows. So in particular, the basic thing about all these rotators and magnetic fields is that they work like a battery. This rotation generates a battery effect which sends current around a circuit, and that circuit may or may not be closed or may be closed at infinity. So, okay, something happened here, but let's hope it won't repeat.
It closes at infinity.
Right, it's like a Star Wars thing. Okay, so the basic physics of these magnetized conducting rotators is that it's the analogy with Faraday wheel or unipolar inductor. So when you have a conducting body moving in magnetic field, in order to move particles around in a circle, there must be electric field present inside the conductor. And that electric field establishes a potential difference between the center and the edge of the conductor. So similarly, if you fly an airplane, you have a potential difference between the wings of your airplane. And if you just use this simple scaling for the voltage that you generate, which is just the frequency of the conductor times the flux enclosed, you get that you can output electromagnetic power, goes like V squared divided by the effective resistance, and for typical numbers, for the pulsars, 10 to the 12 Gauss, you have 10 to the 38 ergs per second that you can emit, And you can scale this for other magnetic fields and rotation rates. So in particular, you have magnetars at 10 to the 14 generating 10 to the 44 arcs per second. And then you can scale it even farther to GRBs and accretion disks. And
I screwed up because it used MKS.
I know, but I
haven't watched, that's why.
That's probably right. Okay, so.
I guess I don't understand a simple scaling.
What? I'm sorry.
As the resistance goes to zero, the power goes to infinity.
Right, but it doesn't go to zero. So you, the minimum resistance you have is the resistance of free space. So 300 ohms is the minimum we have in astrophysics. So as John described on Tuesday, the pulsar winds are most nicely represented in these young neutron stars inside of a young supernova remnant. And so here are the three simple examples, the CRAB, B1809, and VILA. And our main source of information about the outflow from pulsars comes from these studying these nebulae. And the good thing about them is that they work as an effective colorimeter for the outflow. So they most of the spin-down energy of the pulsar that is actually being emitted in the form of the wind, and then it's being confined inside this nebula. And by studying the property of the nebula, you can infer what the properties of the wind are, or at least you can hope to do that. And what we do infer are these weird properties that the pulsar winds are extremely relativistic, as John showed on Tuesday. They also seem to have relatively small magnetization at the nebula, even though at the origin they're probably highly magnetized. So this is the famous sigma problem. They also show this dramatic pole equator asymmetry. They also manage to produce these glowing nebula. So they produce non-thermal particles. All of these properties are nice but hard to understand. The general picture about what pulsars do in their life is shown on this PP dot diagram. And what you can see that pulsars cluster in two populations, the relatively slow normal pulsars and the fast millisecond pulsars. These guys are recycled from the main population. And the main thing you see about pulsars is that they spin down. The biggest problem, in my view, in understanding how pulsars work is that most of the properties that we infer about pulsars comes from assuming that they lose energy in a particular way, namely by using the formula for electromagnetic spin down, which is given by the vacuum magnetic dipole. That is basically an untested assumption. We don't really know how pulsars really spin down. And one of the issues from theory to try to understand is actually get a number for how does a pulsar really spin down. In particular, there is big problem with understanding the breaking indices of pulsars. Standard theory predicts that the breaking index should be 3. It's actually observed to be less than that. And what actually happens in the magnetosphere has been a problem for more than 30 years. One of the interesting applications of understanding how pulsar magnetospheres work has been provided by this recent system of double pulsar J0737. And what you see in that system is these two neutron stars going around each other. The fast pulsar, one of them is a fast pulsar, another is a slow pulsar. And the single amazing thing about this system that I want to draw your attention to is that the energetics of the system is such that one of the pulsars, the slower one, is being constantly bombarded by a much stronger wind from the other guy. And that results in the magnetosphere of this slower pulsar being confined to much within its light cylinder radius. So if we want to understand how pulsars lose their energy and how they spin down, this guy is a very interesting example to do that, because this is a, basically one of the only examples we have where the pulsar is spinning down in presence of some other conducting shell, or basically some other influence. So what we expect to happen in this system is that the wind from one star is being is confining the magnetosphere of another of this pulsar to within its light cylinder radius. So basically, it looks like a magnetosheath surrounding a rotating dipole. So just I won't go into details. Just this is some simulation that I did of this system, and what you see here is a rotating dipole being impacted by a magnetized pulsar wind, and the thing that you immediately notice if you look at the simulation is that this pulsar is not spinning down as it should be. It's spinning down as a different power of frequency. And why that happens is because the essentially rotating, if you imagine this thing as a rotating sphere being bombarded by sticky particles, it will have different momentum impact imparted on different sides of the sphere. So you can see that this side of the sphere will spin down more than this side. So in effect, this wind provides a torque on the star. And how this torque combines with the standard electromagnetic spin down of this star is an interesting question to understand.
But wouldn't that also perturb the orbit, since that's a curveball?
Which orbit?
That's a curveball.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, the energetics is tiny. Yeah, if you calculate,
slow
effect. If you,
slow effect.
Yeah.
So you can estimate it. It's not measurable, even though
it's yeah, it's tiny. Right. So in 3D, this this looks something like this. What you see is that there are some interesting asymmetries that in the plasma shell surrounding this star. As the star rotates, it basically has the plasma penetration into the cusps on the side that moves into the wind. So the open questions about pulsar and pulsar magnetospheres is these simple three questions: is what is this magnetospheric structure of an idealized problem? If you have a magnetized rotating sphere. What is the magnetospheric structure of such a sphere? How does it lose energy? And in the end, what are the properties of the wind that this this magnetosphere generates? Another question is why did it take 35 years to understand all of these simple questions? The main answer to the last question is because the solution is not analytic. So you can't just write it down and solve the equations on paper. You end up having to do numerical simulations. And that's why it took a relatively long time to develop the proper formalism and numerical methods. So what is the physics of this magnetosphere? So on a cartoon level, you can just draw this simple picture. What do you expect? Is this conducting rotating sphere at the center producing the potential difference energizes particles along the field lines, and eventually those field lines start to open, and the characteristic scale on which they open is given by the light cylinder radius. The main difference between this outflow and a regular stellar outflow is that this wind is not going to be pressure driven. If you calculate what is the thermal scale height on a neutron star, on a pulsar, you get a few centimeters. So basically, this wind is driven by either electrostatics or pressure of the waves that this rotating object generates. So what you have at this co-rotating zone extending out to the light cylinder, or roughly to the light cylinder, and around the light cylinder, you would expect the particles move essentially relativistically, and the outflow that you get will probably be relativistic, and expect it being magnetically dominated at the light cylinder. So if you compute typical numbers for how much energy particles get, you get that the sigma, the magnetization parameter at the light cylinder, should be around 10 to the 4. Just from this simple cartoon, you can understand how the spin down should scale with frequency and magnetic moment. So if you imagine this rotating dipole, the very fact that magnetic field rotates implies an induced electric field. So electric field will be proportional to omega cross R cross B. And if you imagine that the field is being thrown off around the light cylinder, what you can calculate is the pointing flux that's being emitted through the light cylinder sphere. And this pointing flux will be given by the electric field in the magnetosphere, this poloidal electric field, cross the toroidal magnetic field. And a toroidal magnetic field comes from the sweepback of the magnetic field lines. So the sweepback, by whatever means that sweepback comes about, either from a vacuum rotator or from currents in the magnetosphere, that sweepback can be estimated as having the toroidal field equal to the poloidal field around the light cylinder radius. So given this simple scaling, you can calculate what the pointing flux is, and the pointing flux for a dipole comes out to be proportional to magnetic moment squared and the frequency to the fourth power, times some unknown. And this function is known for a vacuum dipole, and it's not known for a dipole which has a plasma in it, in particular for arbitrary inclination. So if you look carefully at what the magnetospheric structure really looks like, the first solution that was proposed is that by Goldrich and Julian in 1969. So if you look at this corrugating part of the magnetosphere, and you write down the electric field, you realize that in order for those particles in the magnetosphere to corrugate, the electric field will give you will have some net divergence, which implies a charge density in the magnetosphere. So this characteristic quantity of Goldrich-Julian charge density is proportional to omega and magnetic field. And in the simplest model that Goldrich-Julian proposed, is this space charge density is actually charge separated. So you have net regions of pure positive charge and net regions of pure negative charge. We now think that probably the pulsar manages to fill out magnetic field lines with more plasma than just the bare minimum that needed for corrugation, but the basic charge density that you need, even if you have a lot of pair plasma in the magnetosphere, is still correct. So Goldrich-Julian density still scales like omega dot b. So what you find is that along the open field lines, these particles with characteristic charge density of Goldrich-Julian density will flow out, and that will produce an axial current. This axial current provides a toroidal field, so the magnetic field lines will get swept back around the light cylinder, and they also can open. And they open because there is a toroidal component of the current. So if you imagine these particles hanging in the closed zone and they are being rotated, that will provide a toroidal current. The toroidal current will open the poloidal field lines. So if that works, the pulsar magnetosphere will operate. The problem technically is how you get charges up there. How do you transport the right charge density to the right point in the magnetosphere? If the plasma is charge separated, this is actually a very tricky thing to do because of the because some field lines do not connect to the right point on the star to produce the right sign of charge. So if your plasma is filling the magnetosphere, if you have enough current carriers and charge carriers, then you can set up this charge distribution by sending out alpha waves, and I'll show you how this happens. Where we think the plasma comes from, to zeroth order, it's being extracted from the neutron star surface. So the induced strong electric field extracts electrons off the polar cap. Then those electrons, if the pulsar is sufficiently young and has strong enough magnetic field, they can radiate curvature radiation, or it can Compton upscatter thermal photons from the surface, and that will produce a pair cascade. So you get this dense plasma formation on top of the polar cap, and from then on you have an outflow of electrons and positrons. Some positrons may return back and complicate the situation. But essentially, from this electrostatic accelerator at the surface, you get eventually a pair-dominated outflow. So the problem with modeling this this magnetosphere is quite clearly seen here. This region is not MHD. You have field-aligned electric vectors, so the particles in this region are not described by MHD. Yet on top of this, everything is described mostly by MHD if there is sufficient plasma density. As opposed to?
I find that these jets are inductive.
Sure. Well, they can jump around, yes. The time scale.
Yeah, I've read the story. It's not
the main part of the story. It's just to give motivation that there is plasma in the magnetosphere. However, it got there. Okay. So, if there is sufficient plasma in the magnetosphere, then you can above this pair formation front, you can apply MHD, and what you find if you try to actually solve relativistic MHD equations is that your equations become incredibly stiff. The problem is that magnetic field strengths are extremely large. And what you find in the momentum equation, so you have the inertial term here, and on the right-hand side, you typically have, you know, gradients of pressure, and then there is electric force. This is charge density times electric field, plus J cross B, the magnetic force. So in relativistic MHD, you can't neglect this term. The charge densities or electric fields are actually important. And what you end up with for a cold plasma is near balance between these electric forces and magnetic forces. So what you end up with is the right-hand side, which has two enormous terms, which are almost equal and opposite, which almost cancel, or actually almost exactly cancel. And you end up solving this MHD system with very small term on the left-hand side. So your system of equations becomes incredibly stiff. That's why relativistic MHD codes don't really like the high magnetization limit. You try to push it there and they will break. However, if we assume that there is enough plasma in the magnetosphere to short out accelerating electric fields so that the MHD approximation is correct, then we can actually formulate a system of equations that already assumes that this force balance is nearly satisfied. So you formulate a force-free electrodynamics system of equations. So there are two ways of doing it. You can do it in a steady state, or you can do it time-dependently. So in steady state, if you use this constraint, you can and assume time independence, you can construct this ugly elliptic equation for the shape of the magnetic field lines as a function of the current that flows on them. So this is known as a pulsar equation, and it's been around for more than 35 years, maybe less than that, but long time. The problem with this equation is the following. You're solving for a flux function, so you're solving for these field lines, and this flux function depends on the source term. And the source term is essentially a current that flows on a particular field line times the derivative of that current. So what you find is that the source term is an unknown function of an unknown function, which is a bit of a tricky thing to solve in an equation, because you need this source term to give you the solution, but then you don't really know what the source term is. You have to find it out self-consistently. So it's been a challenge to do this, and it was recently done by Kantopoulos, Katanas, and Fent, and Gruzinov by essentially doing elliptic relaxation in two regions. They do elliptic relaxation inside the light cylinder and outside the light cylinder, and then match the slopes of the field line so that they are continuous through the light surface. And they get this nice solution. So there is some closed field lines and open field lines, and this boundary happens to be right on the light cylinder. And in fact, that that boundary is assigned to be on the light cylinder. What? That's the way the elliptic equations are solved. I agree with you. The question is there.
Mm-hmm.
No, no, no. Right. That's part of my story. What I want to understand is whether this solution is unique, whether this is the right solution. Because what was assumed here that this point is it happens exactly on the light cylinder, and that's just by construction. You can construct other elliptic equations where you have different location of this point, but you don't know which it should be. So what I try to do is to find a way of to solve itself consistently and find the right solution by evolving a time-dependent system of equations. So this is similar to what you do in stellar winds. If you have a solution that has to go through a critical point, essentially this light cylinder is a critical point, you can beat your head against Gratchev-Randov equation, or you can solve time-dependent problem and let your solution find it, find the right solution. So my goal here is to try to reproduce this magnetosphere in a time-dependent way. So to do that, you formulate this system of time-dependent force-free equations. So again, in the momentum equation, I have this cancellation. So I have this rho e plus j cross b equals zero. And what's left of the relativistic MHD equations now are basically two Maxwell's equations, so induction equation and Ampere's law. And with this constraint, and another constraint is essentially saying that MHD is valid. So accelerating electric fields are zero. So E dot B is held to be zero. So basically, you have two Maxwell's equations with a source term and two constraints. And you can easily see that by opening up this derivative, substituting Maxwell's equations, you can derive the expression for the current that goes in here. This current expression is this ugly formula, but it has a very nice and simple physical meaning. So what you have here is two terms. One is effectively charge density being advected perpendicular to the magnetic field lines with E cross B velocity. So this is the transverse current, current perpendicular to the magnetic field lines. And this guy is essentially a longitudinal current. So to zero order is just del cross B. So along the field lines, I have current to provide me curl of the magnetic field, and perpendicular to the field lines, I have advection of charge density. What's nice about this is these two equations plus this expression for the source term gives a evolution of equations which you can throw on the computer and try to solve. The implicit assumption here, even though these look like vacuum Maxwell's equations, the implicit assumption here is that there is enough plasma to provide all the currents. So if you run out of plasma, all of this will break down. There is enough plasma to supply the charge density and the current to hold this condition true, basically that the electric field is, parallel electric field is canceled. So there are several ways of solving these equations. Another way you can get at the same equations is by looking at the stress energy tensor of the electromagnetic field plus constraint of force freeness, and you can derive this equation, basically evolution of the pointing flux and the magnetic field, and the relation that binds them together, that electric field is bound to be perpendicular to the magnetic field. So this is a nice conservation law type of equation, whereas this guy was not a conservation law. So you can, in principle, solve these equations using, say, a Riemann solver like Sergey did in 2002, or you can use some sort of central scheme like Charles is using. The properties of this system of equations are quite interesting. So they are hyperbolic, although there is some mathematical problems when they when the wave vectors are degenerate. So for all intents and purposes, it's hyperbolic system equation, so you can evolve it. What you find is that it's, there are only two modes present in the system. So out of the seven MHD modes, you end up with only two modes. You have alpha in modes and fast modes. Because the alpha in modes and fast modes, the fast modes travel at the speed of light in this case, so all of your flow is always subsonic. You can never outrun the speed of light. So it's always causal, and you never get shocks. So that's the property of this limited system. You can try throwing it onto the computer and solving it. You find that an alternative formulation that was first proposed by Sergei Komissarov is to actually relax one of the assumptions. So in all of this, I've always assumed that d by dt of e dot b is equal to zero. If I relax this assumption, so if I allow for some small electric fields along the magnetic field lines, then I can rewrite this parallel current as just a conductivity times a parallel electric field. So I can allow for finite conductivity along the field lines. That's why the equation simplified, because now instead of this horrendous term on the right-hand side, which was giving me the parallel current, I only have a simple expression where I have parallel conductivity times a parallel electric field. So this is actually a system of equations that I'm solving. What you can immediately see is that there are limits of applicability of this system of equations. First of all, the physical limit of applicability is that electric field has better be smaller than magnetic field. So if electric field exceeds the magnetic field, there is nothing in these equations that prohibits such a situation. But if electric field exceeds magnetic field, then your E cross B drift approximation breaks down. And physically what this means is that particles are no longer bound to be flying on the magnetic field lines. They will just get accelerated and thrown away. Unfortunately, there is nothing in these equations that will prohibit this from happening. And as I'll show, this is actually part of the thing that usually happens is in this solution. Another limit of applicability is that you don't want your magnetic field to be zero. Because if you just numerically, if you look at this, you're dividing by b squared in the equation, so you don't want it to be zero. On philosophical grounds, you don't want magnetic field to be zero because you assume that magnetic fields were stronger than everything else. If magnetic fields are zero, everything else is important. And that everything else is usually the pressure term. So you don't want to have this, and you don't want to have that, and of course that's exactly what you have in these solutions. All of my struggles have been to try to deal with situations when these two conditions are violated. So just on numerical grounds, what I do is I really like the form of these equations that they look like Maxwell's equations, and rather than abstract conservation laws. But the reason why I like this is because there is a huge machinery developed by our friends in electrical engineering departments to solve these Maxwell's equations. And they do it beautifully. What we have is just the slight modification of introducing a source term. So what I use is this finite difference time domain method, which is a quite elegant way of solving Maxwell's equations. So what you do is you decenter all your variables. So electric fields are defined at the edges of the grid, magnetic fields at the cell centers. And the reason why this works so well is because if you integrate these equations over area, so the change of, say, magnetic flux is equal to the circulation of electric field, and so change of this flux is equal to circulation around the phase, and it works very nicely and gives you an exact conservation of del dot B constraint. So this method is very nice. It has very little numerical dissipation, which is both its advantage and its curse, because it could try to resolve very sharp gradients, but then it will have oscillations about those gradients because it doesn't have enough dissipation. So one can add explicit dissipation terms in here, like del squared terms for electric and magnetic field, and to stabilize various discontinuities. So this is just a simple test case. If you set up these two modes. So for instance, what I'm doing here is I'm setting up a wave packet with k vector along this direction. And if the polarization is such that that you excite the fast mode, then what you get is this wave propagates along the k vector direction. And effectively, these fast modes are light waves, just electromagnetic light waves. Transfers, background magnetic field couldn't affect them at all. If you set up the same k vector but different polarization of electric field, then if there is a background magnetic field, what you end up is having an alpha in wave packet. And even though k vector is in that direction, the wave packet propagates along the background magnetic field. So the polarization of this alpha wave is such that the k vector is in the plane of the screen, and electric field is this way. Then what you immediately see is that k dot e is not equal to zero. In other words, divergence of electric field in this wave is not zero. So what this means is that alpha waves can transport charge, whereas fast waves cannot transport charge. So if your system needs to adjust charge density somewhere to create co-rotation, it will send out an alpha wave. So here we get into actual application of this system of equations to something that remotely reminds of astrophysics. So we start with the simplest example of a monopolar field. So you have a sphere at the center with the monopolar field lines. I know monopoles don't exist, but this is a nice test problem. So what you do is you start spinning the center, and you send out a pulse. And this pulse is nicely characterized as an alpha wave, the torsional alpha wave. And I won't be showing you many 3D field lines because they're confusing. So in fact, instead, what I'll be showing you is field line, plots like this. So what you have here is the poloidal field lines, and the color will indicate the sign, the toroidal field. So this picture is this picture. So I just want you to get used to this picture, so because you'll see it a lot. So this pulse went out, generated toroidal field. That's what you see. The poloidal field lines didn't change. So this solution reproduces the only analytic solution that we have for these magnetized rotators, which is the Michael monopole solution from 1973. Right, so I had enough problems inside my domain to worry about the boundaries. So what I do right now is I just have really large domain. I don't evolve it longer than the boundary. In principle, it is possible to do something about the boundaries. Okay, so the next logical case, once you've done the monopole, is to try a dipole. And this is just a zoom in on the surface of the star during the initial evolution. The vectors on this plot will be the direction of the current that tries to flow out from the star. Okay, so after it runs several times, you may understand what happens here. So at the first moment, current is leaving the star on all field lines and all going in the same direction. So at the first moment, the current is going everywhere outward. However, since these are alpha waves, some alpha waves start to curve, and the current that they carry with them gets canceled by the alpha waves propagating from the other side. So on the field lines that are closed, you get a cancellation of net current. And then at the edge of this developing closed zone, you get current flowing back into the star. So essentially what this looks like is a development of a return current layer. So most of the current is flowing outwards, yet on some field lines there is a returning current. So if
how are you treating the star? And so we're seeing grid points inside the star.
Oh, this is just plotting. The star is an electrical conductor that rotates. So the tangential electric field on the star is given by omega cross r cross b. That's it. So if you look at the current as a function of angle, as the solution develops, you have these regions of outgoing current and then regions of inflowing current. And as they separate, the inside has no current going in or out of the star, so you set up this closed zone which has no net current along it. And as you can see, the magnetic field deform. So here is what happens on a longer time scale. Again, the color here is a toroidal field in a weird color scheme designed to amplify the difference between positive and negative. So negative, say, is green and positive is red. Good question. Okay, so the light cylinder in this simulation is at 150. So what I'm showing you is about one turn of the star. The light cylinder is somewhere over here. So what you see is that the solution opens up lines, and it establishes this region of jumping toroidal magnetic field, and it establishes a closed zone and an open zone. So something as you would expect. However, this transition happens to be well within the light cylinder radius. So this point sits at about 0.6 of the light cylinder. So what you find in this solution, as you time-dependently evolve it, is that the properties of it are such that it spontaneously forms current sheets. Even though I started out with no jumps in the magnetic field, it spontaneously developed a jump. So in this current sheet is particularly nasty because it has a reversal of poloidal field. So field lines go out on this side and return on the bottom. It also has the reversal of toroidal field. Field lines come this way and then the other way on the top. And therefore, the total field in this current sheet is zero. And that's exactly the region where, remember, I promised that my equations will break. And in fact, I have to take drastic measure in order to stabilize this method against explosions. Basically, what happens is, since the total magnetic field is very small, the electric field, tiny electric field, will exceed the total magnetic field. What happens, if you look at the eigenmodes of the equation, the alpha in waves becomes unstable. So they start having imaginary velocities. And even though you don't exactly divide by zero anywhere in the code, you see that some waves get amplified and the solution explodes. So what I end up doing is essentially introducing a resistivity that will when electric field is exceeding the magnetic field and will reduce the electric field by force, essentially. The physics of it is this. If the particles do get sucked off the field lines by strong electric field, they will, you know, accelerate like mad, radiate, collide maybe. Something will happen to reduce back the electric field. So some sort of resistivity or some sort of the effect that I'm not modeling will kick in. So what happens at this point is you form a Y point. This is the structure of the current in the simulation. So again, green is one sign of current, red is another sign of current. So you have an outflowing current like this on these field lines, and then a return current layer that splits into two at this Y point and then returns back to the star. So physically, if the main current is drawn by electrons for a particular orientation of omega and b, if the main current is drawn by electrons, then the return current may as well be drawn by ions. And the reason is that at the bottom, you still have this electrostatic region, which extracts charges of a particular sign. Even though you can add plasma, the periplasma current later, but the main current has to be drawn off from the star. So presumably most of the return current is drawn by, in terms of ions, in the form of ions. And for Goldreich-Julian densities, you basically require a Goldreich-Julian number flux of ions to be extracted off the surface of the star. And I'll return to this point later. Okay. Yeah, this is for Crab Nebula. Yeah, not in the simulation. Simulation couldn't care less what this is. Okay, so I told you that this Y point happens to be at 0.6 light cylinder radius. So this happened after about one turn of the star. Now, if you evolve it for longer time, so this is this 0.6 light cylinder radii, and if you evolve it for longer time, it seems to adjust back to move the Y point closer to the light cylinder. So what happens is, even though I smoothly turn on the star, initially it overreacts and opens too many field lines. And then it realizes that it's not in balance, so some field lines start closing. And this is after 10 turns, you end up having this point move out closer and closer to the light cylinder. So by the time my simulation ends, I'm about at 90% of the light cylinder radius. Right. So the answer is yes and no. There are several ways of doing this, and if I don't add explicit diffusivity, then the answer is no. It doesn't depend on the way I'm killing the electric field in this current sheet. If I add explicit diffusivity, then the field lines reconnect faster, and this time can change. So depending on what the real resistivity is in this current sheet, I will introduce different timescales for adjustment back on the star. So in the end, once it settles to this solution, I can actually measure what my spin down power is. And to within 10% accuracy, I get this formula. I get that the spin down is given by mu squared omega to the force over C cubed with no prefactors. So the vacuum rotator would have 2/3 times the sine squared of the angle between the magnetic axis and the rotational axis, and would have zero spin down for aligned rotator. But with plasma, you can spin down even an aligned rotator, and this seems to be the answer. The Michael split monopole is 2/3. That's right, 2/3. Yes, it's 2/3. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is interesting. What happens at the Y point? So this is the total magnetic field and electric field. So magnetic field yellow, electric field is red as you cut it on the equator. What you can see is that the total magnetic field jumps dramatically. There's a strong discontinuity in the magnetic field. Also, what you find is that development of this horn at the edge. So this is not a numerical artifact. In fact, the solution, if you analyze the force-free equations in the time-steady limit, this was done by Gruzino recently, you find that there is a integrable discontinuity in the total magnetic field. So magnetic field explodes as 1 over square root of the distance to the light cylinder, and this is in fact what I'm kind of reproducing in my solution. Of course, this will be limited by I have, but the code is relatively low diffusion that you can actually see this singularity take place. Okay, so I haven't analyzed what the actual dependence is. I have to do it, right? I'm happy that it doesn't explode at this point. So the issue, back to your question of what the dissipation in the current sheet is and how it influences the solution. So if I add no explicit diffusivity in the current sheet, I get solutions like this. Adding diffusion, I get reconnection that goes on much faster. And I get solutions like this. Essentially, it continues to reconnect. Eventually, it will set up, find a steady state. Now, the point of this program is to have collaboration. So Sergey and I tried to use his force-free code to do a dipole. And so this is Sergey's simulation. His code is, I think, relatively more diffusive than my code. What he finds is closed field lines beyond the light cylinder. So this is two light cylinder radii, and you have these closed field lines. So depending on what your dissipation is, you may end up having a different solution, which brings back an important question: what is it really in reality? You know, what kind of dissipation do you have in the real current sheet in the pulsar? And there is no way to answer this question using this framework or even MHD. So one needs to do explicit particle simulations or some sort of analytics to try to understand what the resistivity actually is.
Does E dot depend on this?
Yes, it does. Well, 50%, yeah. Right.
So actually, the question is that if you're close to a line beyond the light filter, are there particles?
There is dissipation. So
you, the particles rotating faster through light?
I don't think so, because there is dissipation here. So
E is still left to do.
Yes. Right?
No, E is light.
Well, okay, so that's because of this is because of our dissipation scheme.
Yeah. He is light in the unit, right?
In the current sheet.
In the current sheet, right.
So the field line sort of bent right around like this. The field line sort of bent around like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of almost a cusp
thing. Yeah.
And then it's sort of there's a stream of particles going outward so that they're not rotating faster than through the light.
Okay.
On this bent field line. When you get to the corner, they can't.
They slip. Yeah, they slip, right. Yeah. This is the interpretation you can have. Remember, this code has no idea about particles. It doesn't care about them. There is no velocity of plasma in this code. There is no parallel velocity of plasma.
But there's sort of a, it's coming in from both directions towards the cup.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, sure. If you actually put back particles, that's something that they will have to do this, right. But the code has no idea about this. Okay.
I know what the equations are. Yeah,
in reality, they will flip and there will be dissipation, right?
So they're being served from both sides of the tube and sort of an accumulation of them, and then they have to flow back along the connection?
Well, the same thing happens here, right? I mean, yeah, there is accumulation, and then they turn and then fly straight. Yeah. It's very interesting what particles actually do there. And the point, you know, now that we have the actual solution, we can try to ask that question. It will be a perturbation.
One direction, the mass flow another.
What?
The current could be in one direction, but the mass flow is in another. And Steve, I think, is asking about the mass flow, which is in the
other. Well, I'm not quite sure what I'm asking.
Yes. I have inertia implicitly in the sense that it quells my electric fields. So it makes them smaller than magnetic fields by introducing this resistivity. So what I'm doing is I'm making a jump from violation of E larger than B to through resistivity reduces the electric field back to magnetic field. Okay, so just a few points that now that we have a time-dependent model for the magnetosphere, we can actually do ask interesting questions about pulsar physics, in particular perturbations and how does magnetosphere adjust and why does it adjust on timescales longer than rotation period. And this is interesting in relation to observations. I mean, I'm not claiming to do any detailed models here, but if you look at drifting subpulses in pulsars, they tend to repeat every 10 turns. Is that a coincidence? Right, but you know, there is right. There is a time scale that's longer than the rotation period. That's all I'm trying to say. So what is also interesting is that this closed open zone is exactly where the return current is, and this is the reason geometrically preferred to have high energy emission from the pulsars due to open outer gap mechanisms. I personally, I shouldn't say this on the record, but I have doubts about electrodynamics of outer gaps, namely because they don't consider the overall structure and don't have the current flowing right through that region. So now that we have the current flowing through it, maybe there is some other physics that needs to be taken into account. Maybe these high energy emission processes are instabilities of this return current sheet. This is something that can be investigated when you introduce back to particles. And the big question, of course, as you mentioned, is what exactly happens at the white point. And whether there is pressure there, and how does resistivity work. Now, just for fun, now that you have this code, you can do all sorts of interesting things. This is a quadrupolar spin down. If you start with quadrupolar field, it will look ugly for a while, but then it settles into solution. So again, so in this case, the current sheet doesn't exactly line up with my grid, and this is why you see this ugliness as it flies out. Eventually, it finds its way on the grid, and you can see that there is reversal of toroidal field again, and there are two current sheets now. And I don't know what the spin down power is. I should check it. You can also do something similar to what magnetars do. You can try differential rotation on the star. So in this simulation, I had only a set of field lines on both sides rotating. So everything else wasn't rotating, but just a set of field lines was drawn. So you kind of set up similar solution, except here there is no toroidal field. So these field lines don't really rotate. Only these field lines are rotating, and it opens up this equatorial region. This closed zone was not much perturbed by the rotation. So given that I can do differential rotation, why not take it to the extreme? So what I'm doing here is the star is not rotating, but I'm turning the upper hemisphere quarter of a turn this way and the lower hemisphere quarter of a turn the other way. And then I stop. So I basically do a twist on the star. So this is what it looks like. So what happened here is an emission of a plasmoid. So you open up field lines and this plasmoid leaves. If I actually draw field lines throughout this region, you can see that there are field lines there's a poloidal flux loop that leaves. So essentially these field lines are reconnected and you have this plasmoid flying out. In the axisymmetry, this is a sphere, this is a tokamak. Basically it has a poloidal field like this and a toroidal field like that. So it winds up around. You can do it in 3D if you just twist some flux tube. Then it will probably emit a spheromak. So this is interesting because what we saw in this 1806 outburst in December, we see something that was being emitted from the magnetar and it's flying into space, pushing against the ISM. I've always had the mental picture of that magnetars look like something being emitted off the pole. In all I've done, I try different types of differentialization. I always get blobs emitted off the equator. So maybe my picture was wrong about how magnetars work. So this is something interesting to investigate, and particularly what is the dynamics of this blob as it leaves the star. You can also do a star and a disk. So a disk here is just a conductor. So if you put down the conducting surface in the equator and rotate the star, in this case, the disk wasn't differentially rotating. It was just fixed. Only the star was rotating. What you get is this type of field structure. So this is sort of what Dmitry Uzdensky, I think, predicted in his paper. So you get this current sheet opening at about 60 degrees inclination. And the field lines become straight, and then you have this reversal. Essentially, so again, this was uniformly rotating and the disk was stuck.
It's not conducting.
Disk is conducting.
Yeah, sorry,
it's infinitely conducting, right. It looks like the field lines are slipping. It looks like the field lines are slipping over here, but I'm not sure why that is. It may be the plotting. The disk is not rotating. If it were, it wouldn't change much. You would still get this current sheet appearing.
You know what sets the
opinion? I don't. Dmitry does. It's actually an analytic expression. It's essentially how far you can twist the field before toroidal field dominates, something like that. I think so, yeah.
Right.
So this is the same solution, but looking on the grander scale, so what you can see is that there was a reconnection happened and this plasmoid is shooting out. So in principle, if you have your favorite magnetic configuration, we can simulate it. I have a 3D code, I just didn't have time to work with it. So I can do limited 3D at this point in spherical coordinates. So I can do a flux tube on a magnetar like this, but I wouldn't be able to do an oblique rotator right now. Yeah, except this is infinite magnetization. Right. This, I have infinite magnetization here. Okay, just a few final slides. So as John was showing you on Tuesday, if you take this thing and you incline it, the current sheet will flap around, and this introduces perhaps interesting dissipation into the current sheet, and perhaps this could be the solution for the sigma problem. I don't address it right now, but in principle, it's very interesting to know what the spin down is for an oblique rotator. And the framework that I have can do it. It's just a matter of finding the right grid to represent a 3D sphere. Okay, I'll skip this. The thing that I wanted to quiz you about is I implicitly assumed everywhere in my talk that omega and B were aligned. So magnetic field was always co-aligned with the rotation axis. Therefore, the main current that was drawn from the star was electrons. If I rotate the omega the other way around, what happens? If my magnetic axis and rotation axis are misaligned. So the answer to the quiz is that you get ions extracted as a primary current. And if ions have different pair formation properties, and as I hope they do, you may get different type of pulsar. So something that was known in as antipulsar. So the... Okay, right. Right, but... So, in that case, if the ions don't readily pair produce, you will not get pair formation dominated outflow, and you may end up with a charge separated configuration. In which case, your MHD no longer applies, and you actually have to do particle dynamics in the self-consistent electrostatic fields. And this is something that I can do with a particle in cell code. And what you end up having is these weird solutions where, say, ions are flying around the top, around the poles, and electrons are flying around the equator. And you get this electrostatically trapped configurations with no net outflow. It's very similar to what Michael had, except he does it in 2D. In 3D, these things are actually unstable to instability. I don't want to get into that. But what I want to alert you about is that there may be half of the pulsars that we never saw and will never see. Some of the isolated neutron stars are these antipulsars. And it's very interesting to understand what kind of properties they would have. I mean, if you have this plasma, it's fairly tenuous plasma sitting there, but it may have some cyclotron lines or something like that. I haven't done the numbers, but it's an interesting case to study. So with that, I'll conclude. Basically, we now have this blunt tool of study for studying highly magnetized situations, and in particular studying it dynamically. And this will, I think, will help us to understand the dynamics of pulsar magnetospheres, as there are many observations that are intrinsically time-dependent, and also for magnetars, time dependence, I think, is very important to understand in the magnetosphere. On the basic physics point, we need to understand what the current sheet stability is and what is the physics that goes in these current sheets. And more numerical work needs to be done on resolving these current sheets in the simulations without introducing too much dissipation, yet having a stable code. And eventually, this will get us to the oblique rotator, which will be very interesting to understand. Okay, thanks. Yeah. It can, yes.
There are only
A stray cosmic ray can do it, yeah.
I can see what ray can do. When I need to light the fire, I get a match, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I start the fire, I'm really confused. I don't need to do much anymore. Mm-hmm. So, and if you have a gap, right? So
when
you start the cascade,
okay.
Can you just stop
the problem? The problem is, if in this solution there is no more gap, the main gap is blocked by these particles. So the E dot B is zero on this field line. There is finite E dot B between this between the equator and the pole, but along the main polar cap, like over here, there is no net accelerating field. It's electrostatically screened.
So sufficiently rapidly rotated down this configuration of final voltage, that gap region where there are no particles is itself unstable. There is assertions, conflicting assertions in the literature about whether that circulation does or doesn't alter this configuration. Michael would make assertions that it doesn't.
Unstable from what?
If I sent in a gamma ray from the
outside. Oh, yeah. Earth. Okay. Right. The question is, how does it
Sergei's match?
Does it self sustain itself? Yeah. That's the question.
Michael claims that the discharges don't alter this configuration. Well, I don't think he's right.
His discharges were happening over here, not in the gap.
That's right. Yeah. That's the viable,
Yes. This doesn't help with breaking in this at this point.
The simple question, presumably you can do the thing with very fast rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that case, even in that case, the breaking depth is not true. The size of the star is comparable to the light cylinder. Then it's not true. In that case, the thing where you can probe that, you see the difference.
That's a good, yeah, definitely, yeah. I can try it, yeah.
And regarding the difference between you and Sergei's, in your code, you cannot control the dissipation?
He can, within limits.
Equal to this size, you know.
Yeah. When I create the resolution,
you're closer.
But I can't do the right thing. So this is increased by 2, but the structure of my interview, I think, is going to be
And not only, in the book, usually by the pulse of the quantum stuff, but for you it seems to be exactly the same thing.
Yes.
Because only approximation.
In reality, the plasma
reality
source will be different.
The pulse of this magnetar practically fused.
Yeah.
So, anomaly of 6-ray sources.
Right. In real magnetar, the plasma source, I think, is different. I don't understand what the plasma source is different.
Definitely, because kinetic energy is nothing, the acceleration energy is nothing.
Well, there is also this issue of pair formation being suppressed in magnetar. So I don't understand how it works.
Yeah. Yes, correct. But no, but it's a question. Why? Because recently it was discovered a few radio pulses with magnetic field about 10 to 14. It's a little bit less than for one anomalous X-ray source.
Right, right.
Yes, therefore, maybe possible also for Wi-Fi radiation.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. That's an interesting question.
Is it true that your calculations are violated in this or they can be some kind of realization? What do you mean?
Okay, well, I mean, what happens is the scheme becomes unstable if electric field exceeds magnetic field. And that happens in the equations themselves. So if you look
but
at
the equations themselves are valid.
That's the problem, right? So they're not. The equations you can write down, nothing will look like it's breaking in the equation, except the E cross B over B squared no longer is the right formula to use. So technically, those equations should not be used where E is larger than B. You can use them at your own risk, but
maybe you could do some realization procedure. Because otherwise the what you obtain from your particular situation could be not
useful. You'll have to explain to me what regularization means. I mean, that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm renormalizing electric field.
And you drop the inertia and only the inertia that prevents things from moving down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's exactly the pressure is actually what's supporting this sheet. That's why I can only have these current sheets when they're so thin that they're within one cell. So if they're more than a couple of cells, then they don't stay stable. I have to, the physics that I'm not resolving will eventually come to haunt me. But if I suppress it within my grid, then I don't have to worry about it.
And putting in the inertia term makes the equations work?
Well, you come back to MHD. My main point was to have the forces balance, and you can start perturbation. So it's a very interesting theoretical question. I wish someone could help me with this. What kind of expansion can one use, and what kind of additional terms can one introduce without solving the full MHD problem?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the problem is that this is a time-dependent process, so I don't think we have analytic solutions for time-dependent situations. In the equilibrium, I agree, I could do something like that. Okay, thanks.